根据那个你跑步这当现在这一天这你看在芝加哥这不你现在这个这不你忙干不干事但对这能来这就不能去显得轻松因为你大家这对于你的这当你知道吧你这个这个有什么意
思是
你假如这第一讲了容易忙容易忙的工作里那就这样就
Peter Valdez.
So, Rinpoche feels a very close connection with Dharma Datu, Vajra Datu, and the Shambhala centers, which were basically established by the renowned Lama Trungpa Rinpoche. And Rinpoche has taught in the various centers. Like in Seattle, Chicago, and Colorado. So he has an ongoing connection. And also, Peter Vault and, you know, people responsible for the Shambhala centers have visited Bhutan, and there's an ongoing program, you know, of visits, people coming to Bhutan and studying there, and it will continue into the future. Next year, there's going to be even more programs, and they actually visit on a monthly basis or bi-monthly basis. Come and visit Rinpoche in Bhutan. Coming to Bhutan in general. So Rinpoche hasn't discussed his personal history today, because everybody probably knows a bit of that. But if you go to Bhutan, then you'll probably know even more. Yeah. Drugla Hagordisra. Yeah, if you go to Bhutan, you know, you'll get an understanding of what Bhutan is like, you know, the living tradition there that exists in Bhutan. So as Rinpoche mentioned yesterday, the Lord Buddha was the son of a king, so that made him a prince, and then he renounced his kingdom and then underwent 6 years of austerities on his pursuit to enlightenment. And you've probably heard these teachings from other lamas, that is, you know, the expanded life story of the Buddha, which basically consists of 12 deeds or 12 actions, main actions, events in the Buddha's life. And so Rinpoche won't expound on that. Or you've probably read it in a book or something like that.
That's the much under the phone, and Pepsari Namdi, 그런 집 배요. 공패비 남비 간서 진짜 진주 샘진데 전라요. 땡이요.
맞아.
와 남비.
맞아.
근데 공기 땡비 남비라 치우세기요.
맞아. So it's not as if the Buddha just traversed that path himself and then kept all the information about how to get enlightenment to himself. He revealed that path to all kinds of sentient beings, various capacities. So he expounded and elaborated great detail on the teachings, and that's what's known as the Dharma. So one way, if we look on the one hand and look at Dharma, we might think, well, it's quite easy. It seems straightforward enough. It's easy to comprehend. But then if we look at it from another point of view, it seems to be contrary to worldly life. There seems to be this big contradiction. You know, on one side we have the Dharma, you know, and then on the other side we have, you know, worldly convention and traditions and so on, which seem to be antagonistic, you know, the direction that they're going. And so it can seem to be rather hard to practice Dharma and yet be in the world at the same time, because they seem to be mutually exclusive. But in this day and age, the way that we should approach the Dharma is that somehow we have to combine the two of them together. It's not useful to go against the grain of conventional life as we have it these days. So somehow we have to sort of integrate our Dharma practice with our everyday life. That's a key point. So if one were to look at the Dharma and try to extract, well, what is the essential meaning? What's really the gist of the Dharma? That would be that basically one is trying to master one's body, speech, and mind, and increase the positive expression of one's body, speech, and mind. So what one's trying to develop is not the negative aspects of body, speech, and mind, but the positive aspects, one's qualities. So in samsara, there are many different types of sentient beings. There's countless varieties of sentient beings. And so therefore, the Lord Buddha taught Dharma teachings in accordance with the capabilities of the various types of beings that he encountered.
Yamin Jamie, Lam Dilacharan Bromido, Chiranga Raleigh.
So we're probably all familiar with the teachings of the Buddha. Buddha basically said, declared that, he said that I've taught the way out of samsara, how to be liberated from cyclic existence. I've showed the way, but it's up to you whether or not you can get out of cyclic existence. It's really in your hands. You have to strenuously apply yourself to the method whereby you can achieve enlightenment. It's not that the Buddha's, you know, upon seeing somebody floundering in the ocean of samsara, can just sort of stretch out their hands and then, you know, pull them out, or send them a rope and then pull them out of samsara. It's nothing like that at all. There's nobody who can rescue us like that. We have to actually apply effort in our personal life, you know, utilize a method whereby we can gain liberation. So applying a method is very important. So the Lord Buddha taught various methods whereby one could develop the positive aspects of one's body, speech, and mind. But basically, it fundamentally depends on one's mind. That's the main focus. It's the mind which gives rise to various motivations. If we accumulate virtue, it's really basically through the mind. The body and speech are kind of like servants of the mind. So the key point here is the mind. So that's why out of the three, having a positive mind is the most important. So whether one accumulates a negative karma or a positive karma, it's really the fundamental factor is the mind. It's one's mind that accumulates negative karma. It's the mind which is the receptacle of negative karma. So it's really kind of like the master of the body and speech. The pombo drago is right. Same thing.
Yeah.
So our teacher, the Lord Buddha, who taught the inconceivably vast Dharma, said that 12 years after passing into Nirvana, there would be a lineage holder for his teachings, and also a very great being who is greater than the Lord Buddha himself. A great being would appear who would be a master of the secret mantra teachings. And so this is a prediction about the coming of Guru Rinpoche. And Guru Rinpoche was actually emanated from the heart of the Buddha Amitabha in the form of a red syllable Hri in the center of a vajra, and that shot forth from his heart and then went off to this lake in Dhanakushis in the Jagat Pakistan, in the country of Odiana, in the center of the lake Dhanakosha. And this syllable Hri, this red glowing syllable Hri, alighted upon a lotus in the center of that lake and then transformed into an 8-year-old youth known as Soke Dorje, which means lake-born Vajra. Or also known as Padmasambhava Pema Jungne, the lotus-born guru. And so today's teaching is going to be on the seven line prayer, which is really a kind of autobiography in a nutshell, sort of. So it's like in a nutshell, his life story in a nutshell, and also a supplication prayer. So, Guru Rinpoche's seven-line prayer is considered to be the king of all supplication prayers. And it's also renowned as being like the essential life story. And it's considered to be quite easy to understand, and yet carries a very powerful blessing with it. The seven branch prayer. Do we have it here? Yeah, with the first page. So this seven-line prayer is considered to be very sacred because it wasn't composed by some, you know, erudite scholar. It's not some scholarly work. It's really the Guru Rinpoche's own production. It was straight from Guru Rinpoche. So it's the product of Vajra's speech. So it's sort of like the ultimate truth, a prayer of ultimate truth. It's not some conventional composition made by some scholar. So therefore, it's considered extremely profound and sacred based on that fact. And that's why it always appears in all the treasures, rediscovered treasures that are discovered by the Teratons, treasure revealers. It's always in those termas, in those treasures. So why is it really essential to do this supplication of the seven-line prayer of Gurumbache? Firstly, not only is it a benefit to all sentient beings of the six realms, but particularly for the beings at this particular time, at the end of the degenerate age. It's called the age of the five degeneracies. So we find ourselves right in this age. And it was predicted by Gurumbache that it would be very efficacious for the beings at that time. They would receive a blessing. It's really his testament. This is like a prediction from Gurumbache declaring that those beings at this time should rely on Gurumbache because his blessing is particularly powerful, more powerful than any other Buddha's, especially because of the fact that he made prayers and also appeared in this world and left us this lineage. So he has a connection with the beings of this degenerate age. And it was really his promise. He's actually promised the beings of this time that if they actually do this prayer, that they'll receive his compassionate blessing and siddhis or powers. Yeah, it's sort of his promise. Gurumbache also, unlike other Buddhas, he didn't pass into Nirvana. He didn't go beyond this world, but he accomplished the rainbow body of great transference. So that means he's still present in the world in the form of various emanations, which are emanated according to the according to what is needed by beings. So his presence is still felt in this world if we supplicate him. Rinpoche needs the prayer too. So it says in the first line, Hong, on the northwest border of the country of origin. This is quite easy to understand just by simply, reading the liturgy here. But there is actually a way of explaining it by using the model of the three kayas, the three Buddha kayas. So the first line, home on the northwest border of the country of origin in the pollen heart of a lotus. That part refers to the Dharmakaya. And then the next part, marvelous in the perfection of your attainment, you're known as the lotus-born, it refers to the Sambhogakaya, and then the rest of the liturgy is about the Nirmanakaya. Also, within this supplication, they talk about view, meditation, and action. So the first two lines talk about the view, and then the second two lines talk about the meditation, and then the rest talks about conduct or action. Also within this prayer, they talk about the path, basis, the path, and the fruition. So the first two lines are connected to the basis, the second two to the path, and the rest of the lines are connected to the fruitional stage. Is there anyone who's really new? Well, you can explore what that means later, like the view, meditation, and action. Just keep it in mind, though. I'll do the same. So whether it's a teaching based on the new translations like the Kagyu and so on, the style of teaching, or if it's the Nyingma tradition, the ancient school, or if it's general Buddhism like Mahayana Buddhism, the view is quite important. It's good to have an understanding of the view. So maybe some of the older students know something about the view, but the newer ones probably don't. So Rinpoche is going to talk about the view a bit, and also it'd be good to refresh the older students. Generally speaking, you know, when we say view, there's one way of understanding it, and that is, you know, just looking. Yeah, the eyes looking here and there. A boy can see a girl can see a boy. So that we call that the view. That's the sort of the conventional term, view. But that's not the absolute meaning of the word view here in this context. It's a pure view that Rinpoche will talk about. It's not the one in accordance with the Dharma.
Mm-hmm.
Rangik. So in the Dharma, we talk about three types of view. Firstly, there's viewing objective phenomena, and then there's viewing the suchness of phenomena, and then there's the view of self-occurring intrinsic awareness. So the first two, that is the view of objective phenomena, and then the view of realizing the nature of objective phenomena. Actually, that's a broad term. When we say objective phenomena, it means phenomena in general, and that can also mean thoughts or mental phenomena too, under that broad term. That's not the absolute view. Yeah, that's not the true, pure, bona fide, genuine view. The real view is the view that one arrives at through intrinsic awareness, realizing intrinsic awareness. In the case of objective phenomena and the suchness of phenomena, there's still a sense of subject and object, a subtle clinging to duality, so that's not considered the absolute view. Whereas with the view of intrinsic awareness, there is no separation of a subject and an object. It's simply a self-occurring intrinsic awareness, and it comes about through meditation. One arrives at this correct view. I missed a bit. The view of understanding objective phenomena and the suchness of phenomena, one can have an understanding of that simply through theory, study, receiving transmissions and teachings and so on, and then come about, arrive at an intellectual understanding of that, but that's not the absolute view. Perfect view is arrived at through the power of our meditation by gaining familiarity with the view. And so firstly, one arrives at the view by having it pointed out to one by one's master, and it's revealed, and then one then goes about recognizing what has been pointed out by one's teacher. So the first part consists of recognition, recognizing the view. And so that's referred to in different ways. One could say the Buddha essence is demonstrated to us and recognized, or the true nature of the mind. There's various terms that are used, or the completely perfect view of reality. And so whatever the case may be, one has to recognize intrinsic awareness. And then that alone doesn't suffice. One needs to then, you know, gain confidence in the view, because one then might, you know, waver in one's understanding and sort of have doubts. So it's important to cut doubt deep within our mind and gain confidence that that is actually the genuine view. And then having firmly established that confidence that that is the genuine view, then one sets about cultivating the a greater understanding and a continuity of it. And that's where meditation is important, is maintaining the continuity of the recognition of the view. That in itself is what meditation is in this context. It's the continuity of cultivating stability within the view. And so one then deepens one's gradually deepens one's understanding of the view through this type of meditation, becoming familiar with the immediacy of intrinsic awareness. So in essence, the view is simply realizing emptiness, free of any kind of elaborations, any kind of conceptualizing. It's the view which is free from the four extremes of reality. And it's simply, it's the true nature, the natural state of suchness that is realized. And one simply has to gain certainty in the natural state, and that's the view. And it's not the view that's established through understanding some external phenomena. It's by realizing one's self-occurring intrinsic awareness and gaining confidence in that. That is what the view is. The inseparable nisimipa dawara, nisimipa, the inseparability, by realizing inseparability, that's the view. So what's meant by inseparability here is the inseparability of phenomena and suchness, or objects and their essential nature. the inseparability of that, and also the inseparability of subject and object, the inseparability of emptiness and form, or appearance. So the first two lines of the prayer reveal the view, which is really the basis, yeah, on the northwest country, a border of the country of origin in the pollen heart of a lotus, that part. And then the next part, marvelous in the perfection of your attainment, you are known as the lotus-born. That's related to the path. And so it's not enough just to simply recognize the view and then leave it at that. It's just like a mother who's just given birth to a child. You know, all of that might have been successful. We have a new being who's come into the world, but you just can't leave it at that. That child needs to be fed food according to its age, you know, baby food at the beginning and then more gradually more solid food and so on. So in the same way, we might recognize intrinsic awareness, but we need to nurse the development of that understanding. We can't just have a recognition and then leave it. You know, it's like abandoning the baby. We have to do practice according to the level of maturity of our recognition of intrinsic awareness. So we have to kind of nurse along the cultivation and do practices which aid the development of our intrinsic or of recognition of intrinsic awareness according to our level of capacity, our ability. Yeah, so we have to be mindful of what we're capable of and what is beneficial to cultivating intrinsic awareness. So basically, meditation here means simply cultivating or sustaining the view. That's what meditation is here. It's simply sustaining the view, doing what's necessary to sustain that view. And how there are two methods that are taught about maintaining the view. First, there's what's known as the method of the panditas, that is, learned scholars. That particular approach, one arrives at the view through deep analytical investigation by analyzing. And the second type is known as the entering into the meditation in the style of the kusali. The kusali is a kind of, yogi, it's a yogi who lives a very simple style, long matted hair and so on, walks around with just one teacup, that kind of person. And but basically it means the naked kind of and a credit card. But but basically sort of just the direct approach, the non-scholastic, you know, nakedly entering into the practice kind of approach. So, in this practice, one visualizes that in the sky, this is according to the Pandita approach, the scholar's approach. One would imagine that in the sky in front of one, well, while one is saying his prayer, there's Guru Rinpoche appearing like a rainbow in the sky. That is, he's vividly appearing, yet translucent. There's no concrete substance there that one can point at. So there's a vivid appearance, yet insubstantial. And one imagines that he embodies all the compassion and omniscience and powers of all the Buddhas, all enlightened beings, and that they're basically, he's the sort of the manifestation of all of the enlightened beings. And so then one would, you know, and do the supplication, and then in the end, Guru Rinpoche would then dissolve into us, and then we would meditate. And in the Pandita style, how one does that is when there's a concept arising, one looks at that concept to see where it arose from, where is it going. One analyzes that concept. Where does it actually abide in the interim between arising and, you know, going off? So one does a detailed sort of investigation on that thought. So for this kind of person who practices in the Pandita style, you know, they would draw upon their earlier understanding from that they gathered from various studies, you know, studying of Madhyamika Prasangika view or the Svatantrika view on the central philosophy of Buddhism. And so then they would, you know, use what they know, draw upon that, and also do further investigation, like, you know, does a thought actually occur in my head, or is it somewhere else in the body? Does it arise somewhere else in the body? Is it in my hands, or, you know, in the trunk of my body, or in my heart, or whatever? Or does this thought arise from any of the five elements? Does it arise from the earth element, or water element, fire element, and so on? So one would, you know, pursue this investigation of like the initial source. Where has it gone? Where does it abide? All of this, does it actually go off into the, you know, into the atmosphere, this thought, after it's concluded? Or, you know, does it stay in a house or something? You know, and if it did stay in a house, then that house would have to be a truly existent house, not, you know, with actual inherent existence, in order to, you know, make a valid assertion of true existence and so on. So you can see that it's kind of complicated, the Pandita approach. But anyway, it's, you know, one would have to, you know, to actually declare that it truly existed, one would actually have to say that that place truly existed, and that can't be done.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. So by doing this kind of analysis, investigation, one then finally concludes that there's nothing that one can truly establish. One doesn't really find anything to point at or anything definitive to arrive at. One doesn't find anything. And so how could it be that something that hasn't actually ever really arisen in the true sense of the word, truly existent, if it hasn't really arisen, how could it actually appear? And how could it actually go anywhere? So if one didn't have it to start with, there's nothing really to find. You see? And so yeah, what hasn't been, if one looks for it, it hasn't been to start with. So what are you going to find? And so one finds that phenomena are basically lack inherent true existence, definitive existence, you know, capital E, right, existence. And so one instead finds empty appearance. There's an appearance, but it's empty when one starts to investigate and probe deeply. One finds nothing. And so then, finally, the pundit-style meditator ends up giving up and just, you know, one hasn't arrived at any kind of certainty of existence, and so one just gives up and rests in a natural state. One then comes back into the meditation and simply rests, not asserting anything whatsoever. And so then, due to the fact that one is addicted to conceptualizing, again, one will, you know, be suckered into a thought and you start thinking. And then again, you apply the same technique of investigating it. That's because of the habitual patterns.
Yes,
sir.
And namto
lambda deni
lambda
samin ninja gibi kwache sunyu denki anasa yine dot gom da bu yan namto lambda yan cher for the
detente
oh ya bon ji shu anasa anasa
gom tadarum teni divi non eta namto chi tam da bu cha sonna
yan
ya teni la min ninja gibi
anasa
ne sun jep dite dingi reme che dio
anasa reme che anasa
la che ba ma ko dio ma
anasa. And then we have the Kusali approach. So in this case, that person would receive a pointing out instruction from their master. They'll get the quintessential instruction on how to recognize intrinsic awareness, and then recognize intrinsic awareness and sort of maintain the view as much as possible. And then they would do a practice like this. And so they would do the 7-line prayer, receive the 4 empowerments from Guru Rinpoche in front, and then Guru Rinpoche would then dissolve into them, and then they would rest in sort of like fall naturally into a state of meditation, just rest naturally. And then a thought will occur, as they do, and at that point, when their meditation is disturbed by concepts, then they would then again do the supplication, 7-line prayer to Guru Rinpoche, and then it, you know, sort of alternate between meditation and doing the supplication, yeah, as they see fit, as, you know, according to the need. So in the text it says, marvelous in the perfection of your attainment, you are known as lotus born. So this refers to the meditation. And this is connected with the meditation. The first part was the view, this is the meditation now. Actually, in terms of attainment, there are two types of attainment. One is relative attainment or relative siddhi, and then there's absolute siddhi. So this refers to absolute siddhi. Don't worry, you get the relative attainment, you know, eventually. If you get the absolute attainment, the relative attainment just comes as a matter of course. It's kind of like on the fringe. It's a fringe benefit or whatever. So don't concentrate on the relative. So then we have, okay, marvelous in the perfection of attainment. You are known as the lotus born. And so the one who has completely accomplished perfectly the view and the meditation is the lotus-born Guru Rinpoche.
Anasa.
맞아요. 그룹체 on his part is not a being who needs to, you know, first recognize the view and then, you know, do the practice of meditation and then realize the fruit. He's beyond that on his part, but he merely displays these activities of, you know, trying to recognize intrinsic awareness and then meditating and so on for the benefit of others to demonstrate the path to enlightenment as an example. But he's primordially a Buddha, so, you know, on his part, none of that really pertains to him, you know, progressing through the path. He simply demonstrates that for the benefit of others to reveal how to do that. So the next part is connected to action, and in there it says, okay, you are known as the lotus born and are surrounded by your circle of many sky dancers. So sky dancers are both masculine and feminine, that is dakas and dakinis, and he's surrounded by billions of dakas and dakinis, who are all emanations of primordial wisdom beings. And then in the next line it says, by following in your footsteps, I pray you will come to confer your blessings. So one is basically stating that one wants to follow Guru Rinpoche and be under his protection. And then one is asking, please come to confer your blessings. It's sort of an invocation. And so wherever Guru Rinpoche may be, whether that's in the copper-colored mountain or the palace of lotus light or, you know, Amitabha's pure land or, you know, Ankanishta or wherever, wherever he is, we ask him to, you know, come before us from any one of those places.
Longku,
or Sambhogakaya, any of the So any of the Sambhogakaya pure lands or Nirmanakaya pure lands that Guru Rinpoche might be in, we invoke him from those places. So the nature of the retinue, that is the dakas and dakinis, their nature is self-arising primordial wisdom. And they're simply the outer the radiant expression of that primordial wisdom. That's what their form is. And you could also say that they're the radiant expression of Dharmakaya or Sambhogakaya, or the radiant expression of primordial wisdom. They're the embodiment of that that sort of luster of wisdom. So I pray you will come to confer your blessings, Guru Pema Siddhi Hum. It says Guru Pema Siddhi Hum. So Guru is basically means Guru Rinpoche, you know, the master or the Lama. And then Padma is Guru Rinpoche's personal name, or it means lotus. And then Siddhi means accomplishment. So like Rinpoche mentioned earlier, there's the two types, the absolute and relative. And then Hum is a seed syllable here, which invokes the blessings of the two types of accomplishment, relative and absolute. So it's a kind of invoking when the blessings of Guru Rinpoche when we utter that syllable. So Rinpoche has given us a brief explanation on the seven branch prayer of Guru Rinpoche, a seven line prayer of Guru Rinpoche based on view, meditation, and action. So right now we'll visualize Rinpoche in front of us, and then we'll meditate for a few minutes. So let's recite the seven-line prayer. Tenkate. Three times.
On the northwest border of the country of origin, in the pollen heart of a lotus, marvelous in the perfection of your attainment, you are known as the lotus born, and are surrounded by your circle of many sky dancers. By following your footsteps, I pray you will come to confer your blessings. Guru Padma Siddhi Om. Om. Northwest border of the country of origin, in the pollen heart of a lotus, marvelous in the perfection of your attainment. You are known as the lotus born, and are surrounded by your circle of many sky dancers. By following in your footsteps, I pray you will come to confer your blessings. Guru Padma Siddhi Om. Northwest border of the country. The fallen heart of the lotus, marvelous in the perfection of your attainment. You are the crown of the lotus born. You are surrounded by your circle of many sky dancers. Following your footsteps, we pray you can continue your blessings. Guru Padma Siddhi Om.
So the first part where it says Hong on the northwest border of the country of origin, that's talking about a place which has all is replete with all the good qualities, nothing lacking. And then the next part, where it says, marvelous in the perfection of your attainment, that's talking about the dharma that is not lacking and time that is not lacking in any way. Punsum, actually, the Tibetan word is punsum tsopa, which means replete with everything. It sort of means bountiful in one way. Yeah. And then the next part, it says, you are known as the lotus born. So that means that the teacher is complete with everything. Yeah. And then the next part says, and are surrounded by your circle of many sky dancers. That means he's complete with a, you know, bountiful retinue. So here in this prayer reveals the five bountiful things. That is the place and the time and retinue and so on, and the teacher and all that. And so then at the end one declares that I'll follow. By following your footsteps, I pray you will come to confer your blessings. So one is following the one who has those five bountiful things. And it ends with Guru Padma Siddhi Om. So does anyone have any questions?
Is there some specific connection between the pollen one part of the lotus and the natural state of suchness? Why are those two connected?
The natural, the state of suchness and the pollen heart, lotus, there's a connection.
The first part of what he was talking about, mm-hmm. why is that connected to that particular line in the pollen heart of
the lotus? Oh, okay. Then it dawa, yansin chok ingo jo misra, my, pema kesar tombo lasra, de dawa ki jarwa karere, da tziki nalara, tzik kare mikse tindi yore, dawa ki danyate. Sik dang pema kesa dongbo la, sik da di dawa la tungi duwe, da chik tungi duwe.
Tungi duwe, tungi yoba yin zang, dandang yin labi pa, kemi ki tungi tungi yore.
A pema korangi.
Pema kesa dongbo la.
Honestly. Basically, the lotus, it says in the pollen heart of a lotus, that represents the fact that phenomena basically are non-arising. That is unborn. That's the symbolism there of that. And so being unborn, there's no onset, and then there's no abiding, and then there's no disappearing, right? Arising, abiding, and disappearing. And so that's what that demonstrates, is the essential meaning, which is unborn. Yeah, the ground which... In the context of generation stage practice, you know, at the beginning, out of the state of emptiness, one then visualizes a lotus and so on. That's a bit different. You know, the symbolism of the lotus there is a bit different. There, that demonstrates the fact that that deity is not touched by the defilements of cyclic existence. So the lotus growing out of the mud, it's not touched by the mud. So that's that symbolism there. But here it's not like that. Right after that? I'll pull up my files and my brain.
Nothing to do with recognition before gaining confidence. Somewhere around the state of recognition.
Oh, so one then goes. Okay, so the teacher points out intrinsic awareness. And then the next step, is that what you're saying?
Recognition, gaining confidence.
What's the teacher
pointing out?
Okay. All right. But the, 가서 뭘 줄, 남의 뭘 줄, 저, 가린 뭘 줄이었지? Ah, that's a sneaky way to get a pointing out instruction.
Pointing out.
So the teacher, what the teacher is pointing out is the view, right? And then the view is emptiness, which is free of the four extremes, which is one's intrinsic awareness. So that's what's being pointed out.
Would Rinpoche tell us about the various ways, the different types you could, of pointing out?
Sultanda Dharmendra Dwe. Sultanda Karikari Yore. That the motor.
No. Dharmendra Karikari
Yore. Sul Dharmendra Dwe. Tap Dharmendra. Then it happened to Karikari Yore. It's endless. Endless methods where one can do point out, yeah, whatever is at one's disposal.
I think she means like the cutting through, the jumping over, and the different phrases.
There. Well, no, but that's basically what Rinpoche is saying. To point out intrinsic awareness, this endless methods at the master's disposal.
I'm just wondering about a certain practice and whether it's or a blend of the two, the pointing out the Dharmakaya by Wangchuck Dorje. If you do that practice with Guru Yoga, would that be a blend of the two?
Come about Wangchuck Dorje, Mengachi Yore, what to Mengachi. Kasa tik chik kasa kasa chik segre tik chik kime nga trabu chik ra kene de namen ya jor chala de dingi jorna dini kusuli pande ta pyo nyamdur jor shaba nashi rebe se idu luksu nika tsul nika de pyo nyamdur jabu jor shaba tik rebe ta de namen ya jor che dini wanshu dorje ki tiki chiki me nga de ra Yamdu Jumna, the Kasa,
the Chiba Yamdu Yore. And the Tina, the Tagin Yeshaba Dabu, Chebom did to get Chebari, Cheba Yunat in the Korachibari.
Masa,
the Dingi Gat and the Kashagi Dingi Yamdu Yongi, Hachibari.
Well, you can, yeah, there's like a combination of both happening too that can happen. But it depends if you start investigating, then you automatically, you know, in the camp of the Panditas, if you start investigating. So it depends on you. Yeah, yeah. If you start investigating, that's. It depends on when you're meditating, whether or not you're investigating or not, whether you are in the camp of the panditas. See, when I translate it into Tibetan, the suggestion starts to sound like a concept, you know? Yeah. Sorry? Well, if you have a question or a suggestion or anything happening in your mind, that translates the same thing in Tibetan as a concept. It's almost like...
Uh-huh.
The Dakshi Chena didn't know it, Marve, Chitang, Kadiana, Marve. Then we'll say that Pecha Dana, the young Namto cigarette, right? Then he gomja do Dakshi Chena young, the young Namto, Marve. Gomja do the
young Namto,
Gomja do young, Jogom young. Kusli Drabu, you know, Namto, Rive, Jogom Drabu.
That didn't so say you gom Japan around the.
Yeah.
삼토 고기도.
맞아.
근데 구슬레 조범기가 빈나 삼토지 되는 거나 고기 요만요.
맞아.
주승기 삼토다 제로와 주승기 세바다 제로이 통과 이 그렇다. 장박수 주 지바지 당연히 고기도 와. 주 지베 주 지바지 기 통과 되는 거나 장박수지 않나. 근데 가지도.
Whether one is conceptualizing or not, that depends on the level of one's practice. You know, that can be ascertained by, you know, how far one's gone. Even a kusali, you know, they can, even in that system, there can be conceptuality taking place. Just because one hasn't gotten to that refined level yet. But basically, in the Pandita approach, one is using concepts as a remedy for concepts. Yeah, so one is using concepts to destroy other concepts or eradicate them. And in the case of the Kusali style of a practitioner, they're told to just simply rest in a natural state, just sort of fall into a resting natural state, and not to adhere to concepts of the past, present, or future. So that means not dwelling on the past, not dwelling in the present, not dwelling in the future. So there's nowhere to dwell, and so there, at that time, you encounter what's known as the fourth time, the three parts without, you know, or the four parts without three. So that's the fourth time. And so, you know, it's up to us to decide whether there could be a concept there or not, because it's not within the three types of time. Yeah.
Which is a female tradition of Kusalima?
A Kusalima? Kusalima de Nadue, more Najama. Yeah, there is a tradition. Aren't you one? Aren't you a Kusalima? In India, there used to be a lot. It's probably, they've declined a bit, but there used to be a lot of Mahasiddhis in India. You know. Dengsang, Dui. Those Yuji, Chachola.
Chachola,
yes.
Kusali.
Kusali.
Kusali, Yuji.
Yeah, there's still a few around. But these days they don't advertise much. They're undercover. Yeah, undercover Kusali. You know, so they might have realization or be doing, you know, engaged in some yogic behavior, but they'll do it privately. You know, not to be on the news. Yeah, in the old days, in the old days too, there were a lot of Mahasiddhas who were sort of undercover Kusalis.
I have a question about suffocation in general, and particularly from within an understanding of emptiness. I get confused kind of who is asking who for what. There seems to be an action, a speech of suffocation to the gurus. With an understanding of emptiness, that's all within my mind. So how does that work? When It almost seems like it's a...
Kurang, tomba chuchi, gitola, some of them, and then you get it. Tomba chuchi, gitola, some of them, you done, you tell me about Tabu, the Nakaya, never Tabu, some hurry, Tabu, the Nakaya, 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 Tabu